You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, Will.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thanks.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show, available on both streaming video and via audio podcast. You are William Davies. You are a professor somewhere within the University of London system. Is that right? At Goldsmiths?
That's right.
Which is like kind of a college or a university within a university?
Yeah, it's part of the University of London. It's one of the affiliated colleges.
And you're a political economist.
That's right, yeah. With a background in sociology and some philosophy and a mixture of things, really.
Okay. And you've written a book. I would hold it up, but I've been listening to the Audible version. I'll show you what. I guess there you see a part of the cover. That's part of the phrase nervous states, which is the name of the book. The subtitle is Democracy and the Decline of Reason. That's what we're going to talk about today. It's a really interesting book because it takes an unusual angle on a much discussed problem. I guess the problem you could characterize in a number of ways. One is that reason to a lot of us does not seem to be carrying the day at the moment. There's a certain amount, and perhaps relatedly, there's a populist revolt, which entails a certain suspicion of elites. And I guess one distinctive thing about your approach is that you are bringing to bear on this the history of ideas. There's a lot of intellectual history, certain amount of political history, social history, and I'm not really aware of a book that tackles this issue quite like that. Are you? Does your approach seem completely quite distinctive to you?
Well, I hope so. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was that, I mean, in my own country, we had this rupture in 2016, I guess, as also happened in the United States, where this election for Brexit went in a way that very few experts or pundits expected. There was a kind of huge sense of shock that something, I mean, amongst many members of the kind of London metropolitan professional and media classes. And this sense that sort of something had kind of quite rapidly and dramatically fallen apart some way, that people had sort of, you know, that the elites had kind of suddenly lost control. One thing I suppose I wanted to do was to at least sort of probe that a little bit to say, well, actually, hang on a second. I mean, there were these books called Post-Truth that kept coming out. There was like a whole rash of them in 2017. And it struck me that these books didn't really either tell us that much about what was emerging or what had been emerging actually for some years. But nor did they actually really drill down into kind of what was the truth that was being kind of damaged in some way. It was just kind of taken for granted that in the old days, you know, the kind of, you know, the reasonable people were in control, and now they've sort of lost control. And that sort of rather sort of simple, quite short-term view of things was something that I thought needed to be kind of given some greater sort of historical and philosophical context. So yeah, I mean, it's a book which is, you know, very wide-ranging. Some people appreciate that and have, you know, praised it for that reason. Others find it maybe too wide-ranging, you know, because it does encompass centuries of ideas. It goes in all sorts of directions. But I wanted to try and sort of demonstrate that to understand this, we do need to spread our net quite widely.
Okay, so now I have a question for you that, as you know, Will, I already asked you, but then your bandwidth broke up, and as a result, we moved you to another room closer to your router, and that's why people who are watching this on video may notice that you're now in a semi-reclining position, apparently on a bed. But in any event, the question I asked you was, and I realize this is an unfair question to ask someone who just was just admitted to having written kind of a sprawling book that seeks the answers to complex questions in a variety of places. But if you were at a cocktail party and somebody said to you, why are we in the mess we're in? Why did Donald Trump get elected? Why Brexit? Why suddenly are there these populist movements in various places, France, parts of Eastern Europe? Profound distrust of, if not revolt against, elites. how do you, at something less than book length, how do you answer this question?
So, I mean, one of the things I've tried to do in the book is to answer that question in two ways, really. One is what's in decline, and the other is what's in the ascendancy. And I think there are some quite identifiable reasons why the status quo lost legitimacy, lost authority, and I examine lots of them in the book in terms of the impact of inequality on society and on politics and so on, and how that has rendered certain economic claims about progress less and less viable. I mean, just to give you one example, in the United States, 50% of people have had no increase in their real income in 40 years, and yet there's a whole narrative of progress and GDP growth and so on. And so there's been a kind of like loss of credibility of certain facts about the world, that certain claims that experts make about society simply don't kind of capture reality in lots of important ways. And I think that has to be understood and not simply kind of belittled or dismissed. But then there is a different type of political authority in the ascendancy, and that is a mixture of the very old and the very new. And the very old is that clearly it appeals to notions of nationhood and a certain kind of quite sort of long-standing visions of community and sometimes of ethnicity. But I'm also particularly interested in a different idea of knowledge and of truth that is emerging in the digital age, which is less about stable facts about the world and more about a kind of real-time sensory relationship to fast-moving environments, where someone like Trump thrives in a media environment where, rather than there being these kind of stable authoritative claims that take some time to validate, things are constantly moving so rapidly, and where there is constant such an overabundance of information that someone who is clearly emotional but also somehow sort of cuts through this tidal wave of content and data the whole time has a certain type of political advantage.
Okay, so the sheer velocity of movement, especially of information, that you're suggesting is unsettling to people in a way that leads them to kind of grasp for a certain kind of self-confident leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. The title of the book, Nervous States, which is kind of a pun, basically, because on the one hand, it's about a situation of political states that are kind of teetering on the edge of something rather disturbing. On the other hand, it's about what we understand as a type of kind of anxiety, a type of psychological and physiological nervous state. But what I think is common to both is that I think that we, as a society and in our economy, but also in ourselves, we've become better and better at becoming attuned to what is emerging right now. You know, this is like, you know, in the age of it's been around with kind of cable news and that sort of thing for quite some time, but particularly in the age of social media, it's been a feature of our financial system for sort of 20, 30 years now, of a system that is constantly kind of moving at superhuman speed in terms of a sensing of change and translating that into price movements and so on. And our capacity to kind of get a handle on how things are in a more consensual fashion, in a way that we can actually agree on the state of the world, is undermined to the same extent that our ability to kind of trace movement is being enhanced the entire time. But as our ability to react and to respond and to trace change goes up, our ability to actually kind of inhabit a common reality is being undermined. So, I mean, this is the kind of the sort of psychic and technological and political condition that the book is trying to grasp.
Okay. Let me step back and ask you a kind of like philosophical question. So the first part of your answer there, dealt with kind of perceived economic conditions. In other words, there is in fact a lot of income inequality, wage stagnation, notwithstanding claims of economic progress. Now, to the extent that that kind of explanation holds, I would call that, you know, broadly speaking, a materialist kind of explanation. We're talking about the material facts on the ground, explaining a state of mind. And you associate that with somebody like Marx, you know, somebody who emphasized material things. And then on the other, end of the spectrum of explanations is somebody like Hegel who emphasized ideas more as having causal power. So Marx would say that the ideas are to some extent a function of the underlying material conditions. That's going to explain to you why ideas like populism or ideas like skepticism toward expertise are prevalent. It has to do with the nuts and bolts economic relations. Hegel, on the other hand, would emphasize more kind of the history of ideas, and as shaping the facts on the ground, right? I mean, this is at least according to kind of stereotype. So on the one hand, you gave a materialist kind of explanation, but I gather that the premise of your book has something idealist in it, right? I mean, you do a certain amount of history of ideas in terms of explaining the contemporary situation. So I'm kind of wondering, like, what do you see as your own basic philosophical bias?
I mean, I wouldn't call myself either a Marxist or a Hegelian to use that distinction. I mean, I guess my main influences as a sociologist are Max Weber and Michel Foucault. I mean, both of whom saw in very different ways, saw ideas as serving to kind of structure the world and to make it comprehensible in certain ways. That if you want to understand how the world operates, then knowledge and particularly influential ideas and theories are at work in how the world is shaped. So if you take, you know, the way to understand our economic system, not exclusively. I mean, I borrow, you know, I learn a huge amount from Marxist approaches and materialist approaches, but I've been very interested throughout my work in the ideas of the Chicago School of Economics and how those ideas help to kind of restructure our economic reality. But I think that, I mean, I have to say that, you know, I don't claim in this book to have a sort of, you know, worked through philosophical premise. I mean, in a sense, what I'm trying to do is to draw on various forces that have led the possibility of a common socioeconomic and political reality to fall apart in certain ways. Okay. And I think that's what fundamentally has happened is that, and this is something that science scholars, so science philosophers of science like Bruno Latour have argued as well, is that the possibility of millions of people inhabiting a shared reality that they can all broadly recognize is actually a much more fragile prospect than is often accounted for, particularly, you know, and for a common idea of social reality to fracture, various things can provoke that. Mm-hmm. One is that people's experiences themselves start to diverge more and more. So the idea of the nation, you know, I mean, the United States is a huge landmass, and it encompasses hundreds of millions of people living extremely different lives. And inequality and various other forces pull that in all sorts of other, you know, exacerbates those tensions. But some of the divergences and some of the conflicts that have gone on within the media landscape contribute to that even more. So I think that's what I'm trying to unpack in a way in the book, is how the possibility of saying we inhabit we recognize the same accounts of what is going on in this society. That possibility has been damaged by both economic and technological and intellectual forces.
Right. Okay. So, and just to be clear, I didn't really mean to ask you, are you a Marxist or a Hegelian so much as are you a materialist or an idealist? Yeah, I gather you're saying you're something in the middle, though. You're not really
Probably more of an idealist, I suppose. Right. But I wouldn't want to call myself an idealist.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I probably, in my work, I guess I pull towards an interest in the history of ideas rather than of doing sort of economic history as such.
Okay. So in a way, continuing in that vein, I mean, I think of myself as more materialist. And so let me give you what my explanation of the breakdown of a consensual reality is. And I think it's a pretty conventional, kind of materialistic one that you hear a lot. You hear two factors mentioned a lot. One is the technological change in the nature of media. I mean, when I was a kid, you had three by virtue of the economics of television broadcasts, you had three networks. And so you could not have a network that appealed to a small fragment of society. And as it happened, the kind of competitive dynamics combined with a certain vague kind of government regulation, perhaps, led the three news networks to say pretty much the same thing pretty much all the time. You know, one was a little earlier than the others to turn against the Vietnam War, but basically it's the same reality. There was somewhat more diversity in print media, but even there, you, for whatever reason, wound up with two news weeklies, two or three. And then that changed. And in electronics, I mean, in terms of audio video, it was a fundamental change that changed for clear technological reasons. On the internet, you can cater to a very small number of people and it can be economically viable. Cable TV was a movement in that direction. And, you know, so people cite that, and then they also cite the end of the Cold War having been a reason, you know, an exterior force that Americans perceived themselves as commonly facing, and that had a congealing effect, and a congealing effect on much of the West. So this is, I'd call this a pretty, the beginning of the conventional explanation, I guess, of why things are very different from the way they were 50 years ago. What would you say is either wrong or inadequate about that? What would you either add to that or change about it?
No, I don't think anything's particularly wrong about that. And I think that, you know, your emphasis on some of the media, forces within this, is key. I mean, I think that, one of the, I think one, and this speaks as well to a kind of a materialist analysis as well, is that one of the things that interests me in the book is, the what you could call the commodification of knowledge, that knowledge is, serving, I mean, of course, there's always been people trying to make money out of media and making money out of research, well, not always, but this goes back to at least the 19th century. But I think one of the things that I'm, quite, you know, that, well, obviously the rise of social media, which has been quite widely discussed, mm-hmm. in this current crisis, is a key part of it. I think, but broadly speaking, I don't dispute what you said. I mean, I think it's, but you know, the, when you say it's when you call that a materialist analysis, that doesn't have to be a kind of, you know, that these changes are sort of stemming from the economy. I think that it's, but no, I mean, broadly speaking, I buy that. I mean, I think that one of the things I do try to do is in the book as well is to get inside some of the kind of psychological and emotional logics of some of this sort of thing, and also to sort of think through where you know, what are some of the, because not everything. I mean, one of the economists have really lost control of many of the kind of narratives and discourses that they used to have a certain sort of status within. I mean, not, I'm saying the economists were ever kind of fully respected and trusted. But one of the things that I think, people have really had to realize when it comes to the rise of populism is quite how important feelings of relative status and mm-hmm. feelings of, you know, like, I mean, it's now well known that the most pronounced psychological trait of Trump voters, which, and Trump voters obviously go the whole way up the income spectrum, and generally speaking were richer than Clinton voters and so on, but the most common psychological trait of them was a feeling of relative deprivation. And this notion of relative deprivation, that one feels that others are doing are doing better than one, shows that there is an aspect of the economy and of capitalism that does not translate into politics in any kind of straightforward way, and needs the addition of a kind of understanding of moral psychology to also be added into the mix. So, I mean, that's just one thing. But I mean, broadly speaking, I don't dispute the kind of conventional analysis.
Okay, so that actually kind of leads to one question. Now, in your book, there is a lot of emphasis on the whole phenomenon of expertise, which is something whose, first of all, kind of historical arising you chronicle. I mean, we didn't always have the notion of an expert or an expert class and I guess one question that arises is, to what extent is this a revolt, the populist revolt, a revolt against expertise? And to what extent is it a revolt against one group of elites who are associated with a particular group of experts? In other words, don't Trump voters have the experts they turn to? I mean, I honestly don't know the answer. I assume that that was on something like climate change, that Fox News brings on these people with PhDs. And there are people with PhDs who say, this whole thing is overblown. But why don't you, I mean, you, I think you have a view on the question, to what extent we're talking about a crisis of expertise and to what extent we're talking about a revolt against the elites. And I think you think some of both are happening. But what is the central thrust of your explanation there?
Well, I mean, I think so. Yeah, you're right. So in the book, I detail some of the kind of historical rise of a particular group of figures who, I mean, experts have always occupied a rather kind of delicate role in public life, because on the one hand they have to be positioned as independent, as objective, and so on, and yet nevertheless they seek influence in some way. Maybe they don't seek influence, but part of their sort of function politically is to have some influence. And so I talk about experts as statisticians who've always played this kind of curious role, where on the one hand they are sort of performing a very important political function, on the other hand they want to stay out of politics, or they should do. Now, what's interesting when you look at the attitudes of those with sympathies for certain types of populist movement and leader and so on, is they, and what's going on across the board, is that often it's not distrust in experts when they stay right out of public life in some way, just as scientists in their labs getting on and doing their thing. It's that point where experts start to become sort of, the boundary around between experts and politics starts to get most blurred. So a lot of the, you know, area where this obviously is, it provokes the most kind of derision amongst Trump supporters and this sort of thing, is around the media, or at least the kind of East Coast media. Mm-hmm. You know, in Britain we have it in relation to the BBC or Channel 4 News, which we now have these kind of yellow vest movements modeled on the French gilets jaunes, of people taken to the streets claiming that there is a conspiracy of particular broadcasters against Brexit.
Do you have actual yellow vests in Britain now?
Yeah, we have yellow vests, but they are unambiguously on the kind of nationalist right in a way that I think is not really so much the case when it comes to the gilets jaunes, which are a much more sort of mixed and ambivalent movement. But they have convinced that there is a kind of conspiracy of broadcasters and politicians and some experts. So I think that this idea of the elite, which is obviously such an important kind of trope in populist rhetoric, implies people who are distinguished by their knowledge in some sense, and therefore it's particularly about people with a certain kind of education. You see this particularly in French society as well. And so they have certain characteristics in common with experts, but they are a certain type of people who want to govern on the basis of their expertise. They don't just want to kind of go off into their university and sort of do things with test tubes. They want to somehow govern society by putting their knowledge to work in ways that then potentially dominates people in their lives and apparently removes their freedoms. And I think it's quite, just give you one example of where I think some of this kind of thing becomes quite interesting, is that you take someone like the anti-vax movement. Now, trust in doctors and nurses to the extent that they are seeking to actually care for people is very high. Mm-hmm. And this is something that cuts across political divisions in ways that I think is quite interesting. But vaccines are public health policies that necessarily have to operate at the level of populations. You know, you have to vaccinate everybody, otherwise it doesn't work. And so that is where expertise starts to take on the quality of a kind of governmental program. And I think that's where a lot of the kind of crisis of trust is going on. So in that sense, I think that it's the communication of knowledge. So, you know, in Britain, most people think that the statisticians who are kind of, you know, doing their mathematical calculations in the statistics authority are probably kind of honest, truthful, trustworthy people. But as their work starts to travel in public life and get implemented and used and reported in the media and reported by politicians, then they think the whole thing is a scam, basically. And that, mm-hmm. I think, is the crisis that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. Now you talk about kind of what experts or champions of reason, and actually maybe we should step back and say that there are basically two kind of dichotomies you focus on throughout the book, and you focus on against an historical backdrop. One of them, I think, could be described as the relationship between emotion and reason, or the relative emphasis that's put on those. You also relate that to kind of the mind-body issue as embodied in Descartes' work. Maybe you've gotten some quibbling over whether those are really the same, emotion versus reason and mind versus body, but.
I mean, Dick, yeah. I mean, I think the interesting thing about him, emotion as a category is something that really comes into, becomes crystallized in the late 19th century in biological and psychological thought. And probably the most famous piece of writing ever on the definition of an emotion is an article by William James, from, I think, around 1880 called What is an Emotion? And he famously in that says that an emotion is something that your body kind of presents to your mind.
So
an emotion is where the body, the mind becomes kind of,
Okay. So this was a quibble anyway. I mean, this is, we shouldn't get, I now see actually more what you mean in kind of equating mind versus body and reason versus, emotion. But in any event, for purpose of thinking about modern politics, probably the best way to put it is, the historical, the relative emphasis put on, or the relative roles played by reason and emotion. And of course, the idea behind expertise is we're giving, preference to reason.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem to always work. And you trace this, the relative emphasis of these two on these two through time. And by the way, I thought a particularly interesting part was I forget the guy's name who talked about emotional contagion long before social media.
Gustave Le Bon.
Yeah, talk about that a little because you really realize that the fundamental dynamics everyone is talking about in social media are in some sense not new.
Sure. I mean, this was a famous theory of crowd psychology produced by a French anthropologist and psychologist called Gustave Le Bon in the late 19th century. And he was a very pessimistic, very conservative thinker who believed that crowds had a sort of irrational, kind of autonomous quality to them where emotions could get kind of triggered in a crowd and then they traveled through them as a contagion, which is the term you picked up, such that people are no longer really sort of thinking or exercising any kind of conscious thought or reason or acting as sort of the way that liberal modern political thinking has conceived of people for over 300 years as being these kind of autonomous subjects possessed of a conscious mind. But people become kind of swept away by the impulses of their bodies and their nervous systems. And that this is something that kind of can travel through crowds with a kind of virality, really.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Le Bon is a controversial figure, partly because of his own politics, which nowadays we would conceive of as being very bigoted and prejudicial in lots of ways. But I think that what is interesting about Le Bon's work is firstly that, I mean, he did conceive of the crowd as having kind of qualities, psychological qualities that are not present in other areas of social life. And this became something that analyses of fascism in the 1930s also, took very seriously of what was it about demagogic figures that allowed people to sort of behave in ways and to follow movements that if sort of considered reasonably on their own, they wouldn't have done. And this is something that, a lot of people went to Trump rallies in 2015, 2016 and sort of perceived something going on in them that didn't seem to be, kind of,
not reducible to sort of individual policy preferences or values, but seemed to be something that had a kind of collective embodied quality. Some people compared those rallies to WWE wrestling tournaments, and this, you know, that where people kind of get taken over by something that is collective and embodied, and isn't simply about, you know, oh, well, I favor a war with Mexico as my own policy preference, mm-hmm. but this is actually a sort of congregation, more like a sort of, you know, this is about the mass of people coming together. So, yeah, this, I think what's interesting about it in relation to the age of social media is that social media, takes some of those same qualities and that virality then starts to flow through other, it adds other interfaces because, of course, there's the screen, the smartphone, the app, the platform, which start to mediate some of that. But I think one thing which I try to stress in the book when I'm talking about social media is that if we're thinking about this decline of reason, we have to think about this as a process of the rise of an embodied form of politics. And I think that a lot of the early analysis of the internet was that it was all disembodied, that it was virtual community, that it was, you know, some sort of gaseous, purely kind of ideas-based realm. But actually, I think that a lot of our compulsion and the way in which we are drawn into social media is a hugely embodied phenomenon. You know, you look at the way people are sort of all kind of scrolling the whole time, the way they, you know, their eyes are actually being kind of manipulated by the design of platforms and so on. So actually, I think we are now kind of wired into crowds in lots of ways. And a lot of Le Bon's analysis, of crowd psychology holds in the age of social media, but it's also something that I think is a kind of, an embodied phenomenon as much as anything else.
So Le Bon might say, I mean, he had a deep suspicion of crowds, and so he might say, if he saw the modern world, oh, this is the last thing you want, is a situation where people don't even have to leave their home to join a crowd.
That's right.
You can have a crowd at any time, regardless of where people are, and increasingly you have crowds all the time.
Yeah.
So don't say I didn't warn you. Let me ask you a question. Do you, when you see the two crowds behaving on social media, by two crowds I mean, in America, I would mean pro-Trump and anti-Trump. I suppose in Britain, whenever they're talking about Brexit, you would see a division between pro-Brexit and anti. Do you see about as much of the kind of lamentable behavior that Le Bon warned about on one side as on the other? In other words, emotion overtaking reason?
Well, so for starters, it's difficult, very difficult thing to answer because it's very difficult to get a neutral view on this. This is one of the difficulties of crowds and I, one of the things I, which is quite provocative in the book, I talk about Trump's obsession with his inauguration crowd and how, you know, although of course, I mean, we can say that he was plainly sort of lying when he said that this was a bigger crowd than Obama's. On the other hand, it's not an issue that it's very easy to get a completely objective view on. Crowd size and crowds in general make it very difficult to come up with kind of objective perspective. Now, you know, Facebook or Twitter can scrape all of their data and analyze it with much more objectivity than the rest of us are able to. It's very difficult. If I look at social media, I get a vision of social media that is sort of, you know, germane to my own cultural identity and my own preferences and my own social world and so on. So it's difficult for me to say with any certainty that one side is behaving worse than the other. I suspect that, I think what's happening at the moment is that liberals, and the left are, recognizing that they got left behind to some extent and are playing catch up in some ways.
You mean in terms of just political success, just in terms of winning elections?
Yeah. And I also, I think of realizing that this stuff is now part of politics.
Because, I mean, don't you think it's more people on the right who think they've been left behind in another sense?
Oh, in another sense. That's true. No, so I meant in terms of this kind of mobilization capacity. Okay. I mean, of course, people talk about, you know, the power of that Sanders had and that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has, and, you know, we've currently got Greta Thunberg, the Swedish climate protester in the UK at the moment, and, you know, she's speaking to Parliament, and, you know, this sort of, we've got the Extinction Rebellion protests going on. So this sort of stuff is now on the kind of green left is really on the rise at the moment. The sort of, the recognition that actually mobilizing crowds physically in public space and online is a sort of, you know, now representative democracy may still be a kind of crucial feature of how government works, but these kind of non-representative forms of democracy are absolutely crucial. To go back to your original question, I think the crucial question is not whether a crowd is behaving emotionally or not, but whether a crowd is threatening violence or not. I think that is what we need to be focusing on more. This is more important right now. And I think that the ideal of non-violent mobilization and of emotional, but nevertheless non-violent, forms of coordination and mobilization is something that we need to, grasp and cling on to and value. I would guess, but it's difficult to say this with any great certainty, that the threats of violence that are coursing through our politics at the moment are coming more in my own country from the sort of nationalist Brexit right than they are from the more liberal sort of technocratically inclined pro-EU side of the argument. I can't prove that, but I think it, you know, there were a lot of people who kind of felt that sort of the language of mobilization of courageous leadership and heroism that wasn't that, you know, that's not really part of how we do politics in that country. That was how a lot of kind of pro-EU people basically sort of saw the world. They've now belatedly woken up to the fact that actually we now live in an age where heroes are good and bad heroes. Well, everyone's got their different vision of who the good hero and the bad hero is. You know, AOC's sort of supporters and Trump supporters believe totally different things, but they both got their heroes. This is now kind of part of how politics and democracy is being done. And I think
what is your saying? That heroes are now what?
Well, heroes are individuals who embody a certain type of courageous truth telling, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. A kind of ferocity.
Yeah. And a willingness to speak facts in the way that a technocrat does, who tells you that GDP has risen by 1.3% or that this sort of thing, or that here are the kind of objective facts about the world. But people who have a kind of truth-telling quality that people will follow them regardless of whether those statements are entirely empirically valid or not, but that the way in which they kind of speak about the world conveys a type of truth that is not as simple as sort of empirical facts in a kind of scientific sense. Now that might sound frightening because it suggests that actually that facts are no longer kind of sovereign. Maybe some facts were never quite as sort of dominant as all that in the first place. But I think that is what is kind of sweeping our politics at the moment. Now, in a way, just to take the example of the Extinction Rebellion that we've got going on at the moment, about climate, you know, I mean, they will say, well, what we're here to do is to speak truth, and the leaders, our politicians are not recognizing.
And maybe we should say, because I think the Extinction Rebellion is a bigger thing in Britain than America.
Right, okay.
Basically, it's an environmental, it's a protest about the environment that I think is going on as we record this, as it happens.
That's right, yeah. It brought London to a standstill for several days, but it's been going on around the world. It's a kind of non-violent, direct action protests in which people deliberately seek to get arrested. It's had a lot of critics from across the political spectrum, actually. But they claim to be standing up for truth. This is what they claim to be saying. This is how they identify themselves. But it's interesting that they don't trust in the ways in which, you know, technocratic evidence-based policymaking, which, I mean, Tony Blair or Bill Clinton claimed that they were basing policymaking on evidence and on facts and so on. But clearly we're in a different kind of moment politically now.
Well, this is kind of what I meant when I asked you, do you see a certain kind of symmetry on the two sides? And I think you're suggesting that at least in this sense, you do, that there's a different kind of truth telling that is now motivating than maybe there used to be. And I think you're saying, you haven't said it in so many words, but I think you're saying that the arousal of emotion is more important and maybe more valued in leaders than in a different kind of time.
Sure. No, I do think that. I mean, I think emotion, I do think that. And I think that, but I think that, I mean, we need to be clear about which aspect of emotion, you know, is being appealed to, because after all, politicians, extremely kind of, proficient, skilled, rather slick politicians like Bill Clinton or Tony Blair, they were not averse to kind of, you know, playing emotional tricks and cards when it suited them in their kind of campaigning and their, you know, the sort of ads they put out and so on. And the sense that modern democracy is a kind of a theater of emotion is also kind of far from new. What I think is being appealed to at the moment is a particular type of political leadership who effectively calls bullshit on the establishment in some ways. That is the kind of space that has opened up, mm-hmm. in which and that is where I'm not saying that sort of left and right are sort of the same. I mean, this is sort of, because clearly they stand for totally different things.
I think you're right.
Unless you can occupy that position where you in some sense are standing to some extent outside of the establishment or the elites and blowing the whistle on it, then I think that there is a mm-hmm. sense that you are, in that sense, in that case, corrupted by it in some way. So yes, that's emotional, but it's not simply the same way it's emotional as, you know, as I say, Tony Blair or Bill Clinton having a kind of clever turn of phrase in a speech or something right. like that, but which then leaves the establishment basically.
It involves saying there's something fundamentally wrong here. There's something the other side doesn't get. You have to say something negative about the other side. You have to say something's fundamentally wrong. And so on, right? Which is different from, say, Barack Obama's rhetoric.
Mm. Yeah.
So to get back to this LeBron guy, I guess we would say, so first of all, he's by definition an elite, as sociologists define elites. In other words, you know, I mean, he's an intellectual, and elites are kind of the people at the upper echelon of various kind of social categories, business leaders, intellectual leaders, whatever. But more than that, he was an elitist, right? In the sense that he believed that the people, broadly speaking, were too dangerous to be entrusted with too much power, I gather. Yeah, so elites should rule, or at least have disproportionate influence. That's what an elitist is. And it seems to me that today, some degree of a part of the revolt against elites is the belief that the elites are elitist. In other words, the people in some of the a lot of Trump supporters believe that these coastal elites that they hear about look down on them.
Yeah.
Don't think that they are really good enough or smart enough for their voices to be heeded. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, that I think is how a lot of a populist rhetoric, I mean, obviously it's not kind of, you know, Trump didn't start it. I mean, it had obviously been kind of bubbling up for sort of 20, 30 years in various ways. But I think that's right. And I think, you know, that the educational divide is very powerful in this moment right now, in terms of basically, you know, maybe it's not 50-50, but like one section of society has a university degree and the other section doesn't. That's one of the key divides running through many liberal democracies around the world right now. So that's one part of it. But yeah, I mean, I think, the term elite is, it's always got a kind of a negative connotation. And in a sense, the negative connotation is that it implies a type of power that is, somewhat unaccountable, and also not founded in representation. Where populism turns into possible fascism is where key parts of the liberal establishment, which are non-representative, but I'm talking about the judiciary and also the independent media, start to become threatened by the executive branch of government in a very sort of direct way, not just in the kind of rhetorical way that maybe, you know, sort of various leaders occasionally kind of play to, and obviously Trump does to a great extent. But I think that you say the judges are an elite. What you're saying is, well, who voted for them? I don't know who these people are. Like, you know, they don't stand for people. They don't represent me. And equally, you know, these journalists, like, I didn't vote for them. They don't represent me. They don't look like me. I don't know any of these people. They must be only representing themselves and other people like them. So that's what this language of elite does fundamentally, is to, in a rather bogus way, much of the time, to push an ideal of sort of radical democracy, which is that, well, if you've got power, it's because we should have given it to you. This is what the populists effectively say. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't get it from the people, then who the hell are you, kind of thing. And now, of course, scientists can get swept up in that, and particularly scientists who are in some sense telling people how to live. And that's, you know, like the, so this is where sort of anti-vax movements and that kind of stuff come in, is scientists who are sort of trying to tell people what's good for them and what's good for society are the ones that are most vulnerable to a kind of populist reaction.
Well, I think with climate change, you see the same thing. A number of the scientists are, in fact, advocates of a particular policy.
Sure.
So there's another big theme in your book, and it has to do, I mean, we talked about the you're tracing the relative emphasis on reason and emotion. The other big one is the dichotomy of, on the one hand, kind of war and conducting war, and on the other hand, kind of, I don't know, you know, domestic policing, and yeah, a kind of a breakdown between those two, right?
Yeah.
You want to break down the distinction, blurrier and blurrier distinction between these two kinds of security against foreign threats, yeah, and security against domestic threats and so on. So talk about yeah, the relationship you, sure, see between that, yeah, and the current situation.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a kind of key moment where there's a kind of birth of the modern state as we understand it, which occurs in the mid 17th century. And part of what the modern state in its classic liberal form promises to do is to eradicate violence or to police violence within a particular territorial unit within certain borders. So Max Weber famously defines the modern state as that which has a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. So that you have a policing, a criminal justice system, you know, probation system, all this sort of stuff. The state provides these things so as to reduce violence within, or to minimize violence within its boundaries. Meanwhile, military power is separated off into something else, basically. And so you get a kind of separation of a sort of civil system of power from a military system of power. And this is kind of constitutive of how modern liberal states are supposed to work. Now, one of the things which I think is crucial to understand some of the ways in which populism works, I think in particular, is to try and sort of dissolve some of this boundary. So as to, you know, one of the things I think is very telling about the kind of political developments of recent years is the extent to which, you know, the military is kind of invoked both rhetorically in our political language. We talk about kind of, you know, culture wars or war on terror and so on. But also kind of how leaders such as Trump want to involve the military in civil affairs, such as, you know, declaring a state of emergency, moving troops to the border, this sort of thing. And that this kind of, you know, part of the effect of this is a gradual weakening of rule of law, because it effectively tries to introduce a situation where civil government is no longer deemed adequate for fending off various threats and for maintaining order in various ways. And it also generates a different kind of authority, because effectively it means that the state becomes modeled around, not around a rule-giving, law-making, peacekeeping state, but it becomes modeled more around a military state, where leadership is much more around strategy, the harnessing of intelligence, and the sort of extrajudicial identification and eradication of threats. Now, things like drone warfare also kind of completely kind of destroy this distinction between civil and military powers, because effectively, you know, drone warfare, which of course Obama was very keen on, you know, it uses a kind of policing technology, but it does so sort of overseas in ways that involves effectively kind of extrajudicial killings and so on. So, so the kind of constitution of the modern state has undergone, has been kind of overhauled in recent decades in important ways. And I think the war on terror is really a kind of crucial part of that.
Right. So, I mean, if you ask people, Americans, what forms of, threat to their actual personal security they worry about, I'm sure some of them would start talking about, you know, homegrown terrorism, right? Which is, on the one hand, has a sense of, they would think of it as in some sense a foreign threat, but in another sense, as a domestic threat. And for that matter, if they imagine, you know, somebody coming over from, ISIS or something, that would be a non-state actor, so that, again, that's a kind of a national security threat, but it's not from a traditional source, in other words, a nation state. So, I mean, I guess you're saying, I think you're saying maybe two things. I mean, on the one hand, there is this change in what people think of as the nature of the threats to them. It's less easy to distinguish between the two categories of threat, you know, a national security threat and a threat of crime, say. As a matter of, you know, just perceiving your own security. But then beyond that, I gather you're saying that really wherever people look in the world, they see the conceptual distinction between the two as having blurred, and that is relevant as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, so what does it mean to present a controversy as a war? So, I mean, politics is all about controversies. It's all about people who want different things, who identify in different ways, who have different values. I mean, that is the mass, that is the sort of the substance of how all politics works. If we all agreed on everything, there wouldn't be such a thing as politics. So, to try and invoke something as a war suggests various things. One is it, suggests that there are certain issues which are non-negotiable, I mean, we have this in relation to something like Brexit at the moment, where people are saying that Britain has surrendered to the European Union, and that it is now, you know, that we are in a state of, we've been kind of colonized in a kind of violent way by the European Union, and so there's a kind of there's a representation of civil and legal and political institutions, not as civil, legal, and political, but as military and as violent. So as to say that we are now a kind of colonized power. Someone like Steve Bannon is very keen on this kind of rhetoric in the United States of saying, you know, that the globalists have stolen this nation, and that we're now in a kind of a war against, you know, Goldman Sachs or whatever it might be. And this is a sort of, so this invocation of war and of violence in situations that otherwise could be framed as civil. First of all, it makes certain things non-negotiable. Secondly, it creates a very, very stark kind of friend-enemy distinction between who I'm with and who I'm against. But I think that one of the things which is most important about framing things as a war, and this is most important, I think, to my analysis in my book, is it suggests that we don't have any time, that we have to act very, very, we have to act now. We are under immediate threat, and we do not have time to debate things, to negotiate, to establish facts, to kind of, you know, reason our way out of this, because we are under such an immediate threat that we need to act on the basis of sometimes incomplete evidence, sometimes on the basis of impulse. We have to react against fast-moving incoming threats. And this is a very different psychological and emotional and cognitive way of engaging with the world, which effectively says that facts and objective representations of the world are too slow and not adequate, and are also a form of pacifism that eventually will be defeated.
So this is one way. This is a way you see interaction between these two dichotomies you trace over time, right? So, So on the one hand, the distinction between, I don't know, domestic order and international order, or domestic disturbance and war, domestic threats and war. On the one hand, changes in that in that realm can change the relative power of reason and emotion.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, people, and I look at this in the work of the Prussian general and war theorist Karl von Clausewitz, who was writing in the time of the Napoleonic Wars at the beginning of the 19th century. I mean, it was perfectly clear in the writing of Clausewitz that emotion and physical mobilization of people's feelings and the suppression of their physical pain and the suppression of their fear and the rousing of their spirits is an absolutely crucial part of warfare. I mean, this is, you know, in the context of war, no one would argue with the idea that people need to be roused in their spirits, in their, you know, to an irrational extent. You know, they need to be encouraged to be brave to a kind of an irrational extent. They need to be rallied around flags, around songs, around ideals of nationhood. They need to put themselves in harm's way and to do basically very kind of foolhardy, self-destructive things. Now, how do you get people to do that kind of thing? Well, you don't sort of reason with them. You don't provide them with evidence for why this is a good thing to do. So in the context of war, it's never really been that much of a shock to hear that people that people sometimes actually consider doing self-harming and self-destructive things is actually kind of worthwhile in some way. Mm-hmm. Put that in the context of the economy, everyone's like, well, that's crazy. This is, why would anybody vote for something that's going to make them worse off? But in other areas of life, as soon as something is framed as being a sort of quasi-physical form of conflict or a type of sort of some mass mobilization, the fact that people would make sacrifices, that people would sort of rally around things that may not make objective sense, people, that is something that I think we're perfectly comfortable with where war is concerned. And I think that one thing to get inside the mindset of the populace, particularly of the sort of nationalist populace, of the kind of Bannon type figures, one needs to recognize that they see politics more along the lines of war than they do along the lines of civil society.
Okay. So I guess the last question is, you, near the end of the book, you, seem to encourage kind of rationalists or those who are committed to reason, as a guide to kind of, you know, push back a little, understand that their worldview is under siege and they need to fight back. I think you mentioned there was something called a March for Science some years ago, which I guess I take you to be saying was a good idea, basically, at least. Is there not at the same time a threat in that kind of thing, in the March for Science, of kind of reinforcing the perception that these elites are elitists, as I put it earlier. In other words, we're smarter than you. Trust us. You know, we're definitely get this vibe from like the new atheists, sometimes, right? Is there a danger that some versions of this can make things worse rather than better?
Sure. No. I mean, that's undoubtedly the case. The new atheists are a kind of an interesting case because I think that, you know, Steven Pinker and Sam Harris and these kind of figures, I mean, they definitely do stand by a kind of, we're smarter than you. I mean, they're kind of unabashed about it, really. And I think that this is obviously kind of disastrous politics. That doesn't work. I think the interesting question to me is what aspects of the human condition, to be sort of the risk of being kind of pompous about it, but of the threats that we all undoubtedly face today and the ways in which our lives are impacted by the environment, by issues that experts handle in their work on the economy and on society and on healthcare issues and so on. To what extent can science not be kind of politicized to say, oh, well, we're all, you know, scientists, therefore we're kind of on the liberal left and so on, even though most of them, you know, probably are in the broader scheme of things. But how can science be, allied to a kind of, I suppose what I might call a kind of preservationist ethic of a kind of helping to preserve an inhabitable world, to preserve, the social and economic conditions of things that people hold dear, basically. You know, that, and of course there are certain people who support Donald Trump or support Brexit and so on, who are never going to come round to sort of, you know, a view of the world that is anything other than sort of combative and sort of divisive. But I think also, but that doesn't account for everybody. And I think that something like the March for Science was not like the New Atheists, because they weren't saying, we've got lots and lots of information and evidence and you just need to believe us because we're smarter than you. They were saying, we really care about something here. And I think that there's a kind of a care ethic and also a sort of putting science on the side of humanity in a way that people can actually relate to. And now this is a difficult communication issue as much as anything else. But one thing which I suppose, and I mentioned this earlier, which I think is, and this will be my kind of final point, I suppose, is, which I think is interesting, is the extent to which concerns about healthcare and about, you know, we live in a lot of Western societies are aging societies at the moment, and a lot of sections of the population are facing problems of morbidity, and there are even problems of declining life expectancy in certain populations and so on. And in some ways it's in the space of medicine and healthcare and nursing where a trust in professional and expert authority cuts across a lot of these kind of culture wars and so on, and those people don't get called elites. Nurses don't get called elites. You know, they're seen as being on the side of people. Mm-hmm. And yet they are still using a type of you know, they're using their education, they're using their experience, they're using their knowledge. And I think the question in a way for me is how, what might you take from that example for how other aspects of expert authority might be reconceived to sort of thrive in this kind of populist environment?
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, there's a lot of the book we didn't have a chance to get to. It has a lot of depth. I don't think we talked about Thomas Hobbes, did we? Anyway, you certainly do in the book. The Rise of the Science of Public Relations with, what's his name, Bernays or something?
Yeah, Edward Bernays.
There's a lot in it. Really interesting book. Nervous States, right. Democracy and the Decline of Reason. Is there a place online where people should turn to find, your work more broadly? Do you have a Twitter feed or?
I have a website where I upload my writings and interviews and that sort of thing, which is williamdavies.blog.
Okay. That's DAVIES. You pronounce it Davis, do you?
I do, but you okay. Know, Davies, if you like.
That's forgivable, but it's spelled Davies. Okay. Well, thanks so much for taking the time. That was a lot of fun.
Been a pleasure, Bob. Thanks very much.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.